accession number 20729, Reel 4.
Quite a, you know, a bit of a risk, but it was all right when you've got a few months behind you, you know. And then off I went to what was then 199, which changed its name to 18 and moved up to Finningley. But we went to Honington for a couple of months with a man called, again, a nice guy, Derek Rowe, and, Wing Commander Rowe, DSO, DFC. Have you mentioned in there? He got this ECM squadron.
What number squadron are you on now?
Well, we were 199, but it was only that it was changed its number for. It had.
One of the most experienced ECM units, yeah.
And it went up to. And changed its name to 18 Squadron.
Yeah, got it.
And Rowe was the ECM. I don't know whether he.
Now, when you crewed up with you as captain, did you have an experienced navigator?
He'd been around, but he'd been on a ground tour for quite a while, and I didn't seem to be all that quite that with it, really, you know. But when I got to the squadron, the CO, Rowe, I think he thought he ought to spread it around a bit. He took the co-pilot, this young co-pilot, off me after a few weeks, put him with the flight commander, and I was given a contemporary, well, a chap a bit older, who'd been on a fighter squadron, a chap called Bell, a friend of mine, in fact who I'd trained with at FTS. Mm. He became my co-pilot, because the CO thought he'd tried to, may have felt my crew was a bit green, you know. Mm. So that's what he did.
Now, when would this have been? I've got July 57 here in my book.
Well, I've got it all here. I went to Gaydon in September. I finished it, and I went up in September, mid-September, to Honington, and was only there. Pardon?
September which year?
58.
Yeah.
And in December 58, which is 3 months later, yeah. Moved up to Finningley, RAF Finningley, which was not only a change of squadron number, it was a change of group.
Yeah.
And we finished up to be the only Valiant squadron in one group.
Mm. There's a misprint here. It says 1968, but of course that's wrong.
That's wrong, yeah.
Yeah. Now this was a specialist electronic countermeasures unit.
That's right, yes. Yeah. That's right.
And what can you tell me about it?
Well, I think it was basically, initially, it was just a primary function was to exercise fighting command, basically. And all their air defence radars, you know, was, in those days, I think they had fixed frequency scanners. Mm. And if you could get this frequency, you throw all this junk back at them.
And what was the junk exactly?
Well, just power, you know, strapped at the same. They were throwing out power to pick up their blips.
A radio signal at the same frequency.
A radar signal. And they were picking up 200 miles away, they'd see enemy bombers coming in.
Yeah.
And it was all to do with which later on they managed to. What was it called? This big sort of owl thing. It was a fixed frequency. I think later on they managed to vary it so that if one frequency was jammed, they could go to another one. But at the time, they were sort of, if you got these frequencies, enemy radar frequencies, and you could pick up, you could search for them, you'd see them, the scanner go around, and you'd try to identify, the AO would identify the signal and the frequency, and then you instead of the signal going back and bouncing back to whatever, you'd pick up this and throw it at them. So on the radar screen, what you'd find, if this was a radar screen, a round radar screen, if you were a long way away, just a spike would occur, and unfortunately you'd be the end of this spike, so You know, if they could get you, he could shoot you down, you see, but you have several aircraft all throwing this stuff at him. But the nearer you got, as you got to it, you swapped the screen, the whole of there, so they could see nothing, you know.
Yeah.
There were different types of radar, of course. There was different short wave lengths and stuff like this.
And they had different, what they call pulse repetition rates.
Yeah, well, I think there was this the big stuff, and then there was other smaller, older stuff. You know, there was but we had the ability anyway to.
Because they're still using AI, weren't they, on the Meteor NS?
AI that
the aircraft interception.
Yes, yeah. Yes, but this was, you know, I don't know whether you've ever been to somewhere like Burma or. Which was the people we used to go and have a word with them and see what they were up to. Mm. There was a big sort of fighter defence all down the east coast, you know, and they got these big radar pictures and the pictures are displayed not on a radar screen but on the on a sort of a map affair, you know, and the fighter controllers would be there sending. But sort of they got a warning, they were on an unidentified aircraft even in those days, because the Russians used to send over the odd aeroplane over the North Sea.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Did you ever go out near Russia to listen out for their frequencies?
We used to, well, we weren't, there was a squadron, overt squadron, big trying to go down the blue line, as they call it, picking up the, trying to pick up these frequencies. It was all intelligent stuff, you know.
You weren't
and
that.
We weren't doing that. No, I think that was left to... a piston engine aircraft at Watton, I believe. They were somebody doing it. We weren't doing that now.
Well, the Americans used to send B-47s up there, and in fact, they had a couple shot down.
There was lots of silly things going on, you know, even in the Cambridge. It was some sort of macho game that was going on, and people would appear to be. The Russians would do the same, you know, as if they were coming. With a bloody great broad front and everybody in flap, and then they get to the blue line and turn back. It was a lot of the stupid gamesmanship, you know.
Well, Canberra was actually overflying Russia, wasn't it?
Well, one or two, when I come through it later, when I finished up in Bomber Command Headquarters in the ops room, and occasionally you get aircraft accidentally going over, you know, this sort of thing, you know, causing a bit of a stir, Russian coming over here and whatever. But it was quite a performance over the North Sea. I think the Russians used to, because it was free airspace, I think, international airspace. It didn't belong to us. But they used to send over their whatever. And the fighter command would send up a lightning and they'd wave to each other. Mm. And, you know.
In your ECM role on Valiance, I mean, how. Did you still have the same number of crew?
Yes, except that instead of two navs, we had one nav and two AOs.
Who would be responsible for all the jamming?
That's right. Yeah. In fact, we had a funny outfit, really, because we were the only... invariably, the other AO was a signaller, master signaller, wasn't commissioned a lot. They were hairy old...
Key tappers,
but they were interchangeable, but... Bit awkward, really, because you go somewhere and you've got one senior NCO and...
Isn't it ridiculous?
And all, eh?
Ridiculous,
isn't it? It is, You know, we found that when we were getting involved with a raid or an exercise, we'd all be in flying kit waiting to... And then these, you know, they did eventually put them in the officer's mess, believe it or not, for... to eat in their flying kit, because there was nothing. He was either that or pick up a vehicle and delay while he went to the sergeant's mess to pick him up. So there was a silly old business.
More on flying the Valiant. I mean, you were being virtually a bus driver then, weren't you? Just flying around and.
Yes, actually, we got to be. Yeah, it was just all the exercises, and I say, you know, an awful lot of what they called CT, continuation training, just going off and approach after approach and circuit, you know, it was just to keep everybody... in fact, I think we were knocking the hell out of the aeroplane sometimes, and I think they were trying at this stage to say if you want a select crew or your experienced crew, to keep the hours down. There's no need for this chasing hours. But it was ingrained, you know, was to get hours, get your hours. Everybody was aligned to always aligned to beat, to get...
What sort of endurance did the Valiant have? I mean, how
I think we, well, it wasn't until the later on our squad had get the underwing tanks, you remember?
Yeah.
Not drop tanks.
They were fixed,
though. Yeah, we had those tanks fitted to go to estates, Western Rangers, as they call them.
Yeah.
And...
good picture of it here.
Yes, that's right. But we flew for a long time without them, we did. Yeah. And then to go over to the States for Western Rangers to offer the American Air Force headquarters, SAC headquarters.
You went to the States, did you?
Yeah, a couple of times, yeah.
But did you go on any SAC competitions or not?
I went over with them as a bomber, though,
yeah,
to Offutt as a co-pilot. But later on, when I went over as an ECM man, we called it... Joint Civil Military Montreal. We stopped there for some, get some spare parts from the Canadians, and then went down to Offutt. But we weren't bombers then, no.
Now, you had full autopilots and so on, didn't you?
Later on, yes, it was fairly late, the last couple of years, really, that our squadron, we were flying it all the time, you know, 50-50. But then later on, the autopilots, quite nice, the automatic, you know, ILSs would be done by autopilot and stuff like that.
You had ILS, obviously.
Yes, that's right, and that was, it worked quite well, I quite enjoyed that.
What height could you get to?
Very similar performance to the Canberra, you know. 48.
Very similar. The Falcons, I think, could get up to about 60, couldn't they?
Yes, I think they got the world height record. Although the Canberra got
the
world
height record
once.
I
interviewed
the guy who did it.
That's right. Yes.
68,000.
Six something fantastic. Yes.
That was with Olympuses.
What was I going to say about the
flying to America?
No. Yeah, I can't try it. This would be interesting. There was a time when we were some sort of, it developed into some sort of an elite, you know,
yeah,
as an outfit.
Yeah.
And it was all to do with the, I think, Air Marshal Cross, Air Chief Marshal Cross, you know. But we used to get flying rations to take with us, soup and things like that, and chocolate and crummy biscuits that used to get into the masks and things, you know. And most people never bother. We might have a tin of soup occasionally, but nobody bothered with all this tin meat and all sorts of stupid things, you know. So somebody actually wrote to Air Close Office, the Bomber magazine, compared their food to the Americans' in-flight rations, you know, saying, you know, it's, you don't want to eat this sort of stuff, dry biscuits, and get it, you know, they had sandwiches with nice lobster and stuff like this. Anyway, so something dramatically happened when I was at Fitting, because all the bomber bases suddenly developed this air crew canteen thing, you know. It was quite ridiculous, really. You'd go and have a pre-flight meal, a breakfast or whatever, you know, and then you'd get a big box with chocolates and sandwiches and stuff like this to take with you. Sometimes you'd only do it a couple of hours or 3 hours, and then come back for a post-flight meal, you know. It was all free, you know, and all these married men were, you know, we all get like this, and the chaps that were paying for their messing in the mess thought, what the hell have they done? They're never eating in there, you know what I mean? But he took flowers on the table. We suddenly went, went mad. We were specially selected. And so much so that down at Malta, which was a transport command base, they had a little section behind screens, you know, and it was V-Force only, which went down great fun with the bloody Comet people. we were having our steaks and stuff, you know.
And they were all
and all the Canberra boys who were freezing and, you know, having a right old flog down there and whatever. We were going down there in luxury, you know, with the soup crew and soup and stuff, and then coming back, you know. Yeah. And I think somebody decided to, some sort of an elite was... Which is all very nice, of course, you know. The V-Force.
You mentioned you did some flight refueling trials.
No, we didn't. We were threatening to, as they said.
Yeah.
And they came, Bryce and Trubshaw, they brought their aircraft down and we were going to do it as a squadron. It was supposed to be a trial squadron. But they only did that one flight. I flew with... They did a quick demonstration, but higher up the system, they decided this was silly to train what we were mainly main force, really. Why not get a proper tanker squadron and let them do it, which is what they in fact did, yeah.
Your trips to America, I mean, as a co-pilot you went out, did you?
I went as a co-pilot.
Yeah.
You heard about the Prang over there, did you? Ever heard the Valiant that crashed over there? Yeah, well, it happened just before we went over there. It was an offer there at Air Force Base. The thing had been heavy rain and they left the pitot head covers off, so there was water down the pitot head, you know what I mean, where it registers the airspeed.
Yeah.
And they took taking off and it appeared as if they weren't accelerating. In fact, what it was water down the bloody... So they left it a bit late to throttle back and tried to stop and went off the end of the runway, you know. They all walked away, but wrecked the aeroplane.
Were you in the bombing competition? Did you ever do any trips? No,
as I said to you, I was going.
You were going, yeah.
But because, as I said, I've got some trips in there training for it, to go SAC training, you know, go to America. But as the boss said, you know, you go back to Gaydon and get your crew and somebody else will have this.
What did you do when you went to America?
Not a lot. It was quite hard work, Will, you know. They didn't give you much time off, you know. It was, went to America the second time with the ECM. And that was quite interesting. Went to their headquarters, NORAD, where they've got the line, you know, across them, the defence line from over the poles to Canada. And saw all their air defence radars up, and they showed us around there, you know. And
you didn't fly in any American aircraft?
Oh no, we were in. They used us to intercept us, you know. As targets, you know, just for laughs, frighten the life out of me, you know. They come at you, do it on purpose, and they just hop over the top, you know. Just,
they could get up to your height.
Yeah. And they got it. They were always do quarter attacks, you know, like this. You think, bloody hell, you know, and then you do this, you know. But you wouldn't have much time. You'd be off again, and might get a day off. But you were there to work, supposedly, you know. They didn't give you a nice couple of days off to see what was going on, you know. We had the best time we went was we fixed up these Montreal. That was somehow fiddled just for us. And that was very enjoyable. The Canadians were very good to us, you know. They'd always, Station Commander insisted that we always had a driver and a car to take us out for a night down into Montreal, you know, all on the Canadians, you know, very nice. You know,
really. Where were you based, on the airport?
This was at Montreal itself, you know, but and we used to pick up I don't know whether it was all done officially, pick up the... We had a Canadian officer, you see, on the squadron who was looking after this ECM stuff, an exchange officer, and he used to send, give us a list of big spares to bring back for the stuff he couldn't get very well back here, and I used to give this to a chiefie, and he'd put it in the bomber, you know. So I don't know whether it was all paid for or what, you know. That's the way we think. That's how it was.
When you deployed, say, to Montreal or Cyprus or Malta, I mean, you presumably your ground crew flew out.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Did they come
yes.
out in Britannia or something? Or?
Yes, that's right. They'd yeah. be probably taken out by transport command, you know.
With any spare
and even, and that's right. And I, in fact, I was out, when I went out in Cyprus, and that gratuitous, but was when all the troubles were over and it was its sovereign base by now. I came back by, oh goodness me, what was that? I got myself stabbed with a kebab stick. I organised a party on the beach, a few beers and a barbecue with a squadron and ground crew and everybody going back. And then somebody said to me, this kebab stick, here you are, and I was in a bathing costume, and this thing went like a sword. It went into me, and I gave it a little rub and not worried too much, but it got infected, and I found myself in big trouble in the hospital. And I came back with the ground crew, and my crew. What were those things, the twin boom?
Oh, the Argosies.
No, before the Argosy.
Twin boom.
Yeah,
Beverly.
Yeah. What a flight that was. It flew from Cyprus to Malta, Malta to UK. That went on forever, that thing. I think it cruised about 140 knots, if you're lucky. Yeah. And I think it was over 8 hours or something trying to get back to the... And in those aircraft, they hadn't got an autopilot.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, they were being... pan-polled all the way, you know, all those hours.
I spoke to someone who flew one across France, and all the traffic on the road was overtaking them.
Yeah, I could believe it. Yeah, well, a bit like this, coming back up this...
You came back in a Beverly then, did you?
I came back in a Beverly because I was... in fact, I wasn't still quite well. I spent about 3 or 4 days in this hospital, you see. And I was had quite a fever, really. And there was a bit of a debate whether to let me go or not, but they decided that I'll get this Beverly, I'll be all right.
How long was your tour then on Valiance at the end?
Well, it...
It was only ECM that you were involved in.
Mainly, that's right. Actually, it all went... It was a good time, except, to be honest, the... Rowe was the CO, was a good guy, and he had asked to leave the service for one of, you know, resign or something for something. He was living in quarters or something, not being married or something like that.
Yeah.
And there's a wing commander. And was replaced by another CO I hadn't ought to mention, really. But he was a... managed to get air rank, but my God, he was horrible.
Yeah.
Really was a nasty... no good at all. So I when did I leave that then? It's and then I say I finished up. I went to headquarters bomber command when my tour was up. The tour length started to be much longer under V4. So talking about 7 years as opposed to one time, two or three, you know, and. I spent a couple of years as operations officer at on shift duty in the waiting for a war in the in the hole at High Wycombe, you know, the underground on shifts, just going in there waiting for, you know, an alert or
that
whatever.
That was connected to all the East Coast radars.
Oh yeah, the BMUs and the early warning radars and all this sort of stuff. Fighter command, you know, all these. But Or it was just a waiting job. I mean, I didn't do it a great deal of signals come in and you just... But what happened was an exercise, of course, come along, or a war. I have a list to call out, you know, all the operations people, and they'd all go upstairs and man the bridge, as they called it.
You were all completely sort of trained for that contingency.
Well, there were people, experts, supposedly. All the staff officers would come in, and there was a room for the CNC to operate, and, you know, all these stuff was recorded. Anything he said was all recorded by the... So he knew people gave him... He could have recourse to what he's been told over the secret phones and things like this, you know. And that was the odd exercise. The odd bomb ex and things like that would be organised by the bridge, you know.
And this operations centre, of course, was deep down and...
Yes, now it's even bigger now. It's they've dug out a big hole there for European... It's a hell of a size now, yeah, but it's...
And it's nuclear-proof, isn't it?
This, yeah, now it is, but it would look like... It used to be a... It was very much like the 45 war, you know, was their headquarters then, under the ground, you know, and things hadn't moved all that much. It's, there was a guard on the, you know, with a revolver as you steel gate to get in and out, this sort of thing, downstairs. But I did a couple of years there. And then what I would like to get back to is that was going to send me back. I wriggled. I didn't want to go. I didn't want, you never do when you fly. You want to carry on flying. You don't want a ground tour. See. And I tried to get out of this posting, but they said, yes, where you go. So the guy that was running the posting, he phoned me up and said, you know, you're due to go now. You're posting again. He said, yeah, you are. And he said, talking about, there was a Valiant at Pershaw, which eventually crashed, doing trials for the Pershaw RRA. Yes, that's mine.
Yeah.
That's right. Mm. And how would you like to go there? And he said, oh, well, lovely, a civilian establishment, just me with a crew. I thought, yeah, just the job. Anyway, before I could... he phoned me up and I came back from leave. He said, I'm sorry, somebody else has got it. I said, yeah, you bet your sweet life they have, you know. And he said, well, he said, I'm posting you to Marham. Now, I don't know whether Marham was Aladdin with grass as far as we were concerned, you know, in the middle of Norfolk with nothing. I said, you must be joking. I said, you know, I'm up there with the bomber command now. I've done nothing else, you see, but bomber. So eventually he said, how do you fancy going back to Canberra's then, signals command, you know, what?